This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about the U.S. El Salvador Sister Cities Network. And with me are two people who are intimately involved with it. Sarah Bishop is the U.S. coordinator of the group, and also in the studio, Agustin Mejibar. He's the president of a branch of the Association for the Development of El Salvador, and the two groups work very closely together. Sarah, Agustin, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Sarah, let me start with you and tell me a little bit about your personal background and how you got involved in this work.
Sure. Yeah, I've been working for the U.S. Office of Sister Cities for about a year and a half and worked in El Salvador for 2 years before that. And I got involved because I went down to El Salvador as a young person and was really impressed at the community organizing and the commitment in those communities of El Salvador to social justice and to community development. And what really inspired me was the fact that in the U.S., there's a fair amount of apathy, that we live in a very powerful country, but we feel like we don't have the power to do things. And then to be in a community where everyone was working together despite the difficult times that people face was a very inspiring reason to work on solidarity with El Salvador.
And for people who don't know what a sister city is or a sister city relationship is, could you explain that briefly?
Yeah, so we work with 17 sister cities. So there's cities in the U.S. Madison, Wisconsin is an example, sistered with Arcatao, a small community in Chalatenango, a rural area of El Salvador, and there's 16 other ones. And so these sister cities began in the 1980s. During the Civil War in El Salvador, the U.S. was funding the Salvadoran military, and there was terrible human rights violations and thousands of people that were murdered and a large number of people that were forced to flee the country to refugee camps in Nicaragua and Honduras fled to the U.S. And an organization called the Association for the Development of El Salvador, CRIPTIS, began with the focus on supporting those refugees, working for the human rights of the displaced people in the country. And as people began to return to their homes, still during the war, returning from the refugee camps, wanting to rebuild their lives, CRIPTIS decided that a good strategy would be to reach out to folks in the U.S. to build relationships of solidarity between communities that were repopulating, that were going back to their homes to rebuild their communities from scratch, and groups in the U.S. so that there would be some people paying attention to human rights violations in those communities. And so that's how those relationships started.
I wanted to ask Agustin Mejibar what the importance of the sister cities relationship is to him and to his organization.
Para usted y para CRIPTIS, ¿qué es la importancia de las relaciones de ciudades hermanas?
Bueno, gracias por...
De nada.
Por estar acá en este canal. Y y un saludo desde El Salvador por este espacio que nos están dando para poder contarles esa realidad. Y es que la verdad es de que, o sea, Ciudades Hermanas es como la voz en el extranjero para poder hacer valer nuestros derechos. Aparte de nuestra lucha en El Salvador, pues Ciudades Hermanas es como la voz en el exterior.
And so, Sarah, translate that if you would. My Spanish
sure.
just is not that good, and I'm sure some of our listeners can't grab it either.
Thank you so much for being here, and greetings from El Salvador. To say what Sister Cities means to us, we see Sister Cities as our voice focusing on human rights and our fight for justice outside of El Salvador.
The U.S. El Salvador Sister Cities, it does have that kind of 80s connotation to me, someone who's been following politics closely, but lost touch with what's been going on in El Salvador since the Civil War ended. And so, Sarah, it's still an organic kind of development, this relationship between the 17 U.S. cities and the cities in El Salvador. It's not like the work has evaporated.
No, not at all. We've seen that the importance of making these relationships across barriers, across our countries, and learning from each other hasn't lost importance as the war ended and as time has gone on. And so we continue to look at issues that affect both El Salvador and the U.S. and advocate around them. So, for example, CAFTA, the free trade agreement between the U.S. and Central America, is an example of an important issue that affects both El Salvador and us in the U.S. that we advocate around. And a most recent issue that we've been working on is related to North American mining companies that are attempting to extract gold in El Salvador.
And Agustine, then, CAFTA, what impact has that had on the people of El Salvador?
¿Qué impacto tiene el TLC para la gente de El Salvador?
Pues el impacto es que hemos perdido muchos derechos como salvadoreños. No ha habido el anuncio, la publicidad que llevaba que las empresas de El Salvador serían beneficiadas para vender productos. De lo contrario, lo que ha sucedido es que El Salvador ha sido invadido por empresas más fuertes y que tienen capacidad de manufacturar con menos costo algunos productos, y eso pues lo que hace es quebrar nuestras pequeñas empresas en El Salvador.
So the impact of the free trade agreements in El Salvador has been the loss of many rights for Salvadorans. When the free trade agreements were passed, the publicity was that our Salvadoran businesses would benefit. We would be able to sell more, have more production. But what really happened was that U.S. businesses invaded our country, and these bigger companies outcompeted our small companies by manufacturing with less cost. And that's broken our manufacturing system.
And Sarah, you mentioned mining a little bit ago, too. I understand that some North American companies, first a U.S. company and then a Canadian company, have been using CAFTA as a lever, as a wedge to extract, if they can't extract the minerals, they want to extract money from the government of El Salvador. It's my understanding that the government of El Salvador now, both under the right-wing government and under the left-wing government now, said they didn't want mining and weren't issuing any more mining permits. As a result, the companies who had surveyed for mining or spent some money there building roads, I don't know what they were doing actually, are now suing. What's going on there?
Yeah, so the communities that would be affected by the gold mining, by the cyanide use and the water use, the pollution of the main rivers, started a very large movement in El Salvador against mining that became a coalition of both communities, NGOs, churches, that grew so strong that both the right-wing and left-wing presidents have said, we won't allow mining. And so that's when the two mining companies, Pacific Rim in Canada and Commerce Group from Milwaukee, sued the Salvadoran government under CAFTA, under Chapter 10, which says that an investor has the right to reap the gains of their investment and their potential investment. So what they would have, their potential gains, should the government not allow them to continue mining. So that's why they're suing for a total of $177 million for not being allowed to mine when the decision to not let them mine was because the communities saw the damages that mining was causing, advocated to their government, and the government responded in a very democratic way and said, we're not going to do this thing that people are so concerned about. And then now it's our North American companies that are suing the government because they responded to the needs of the people.
So it's not like they spent $177 million. There's maybe gold in the mines worth $177 million that they can't get at, so they're suing the government of El Salvador because they can't grab the gold that is El Salvador's?
Exactly. CAFTA says your potential gains from the investment, not just the money you invest.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Agustin, if I might ask you a question, why are you and why is your organization opposed to mining?
¿Por qué usted y su organización está en contra de la minería?
Es un, bueno, a raíz de algunos estudios que se han hecho de impacto de la minería de San Sebastián en La Unión, que ahí ha habido explotación minera desde el año 1904, y hoy se ven los resultados de esa explotación minera, y es el drenaje ácido que fluye sobre el río, y otros efectos que se ven pues en algunas enfermedades, y a la vez, o sea, es una avalancha de empresas, como alrededor de 70 empresas solicitando el territorio salvadoreño para hacer ese tipo de explotación a los puntos mineros, y el gobierno había concesionado como unos 50 kilómetros cuadrados a cada empresa. Entonces, eso acabaría con nuestro pequeño espacio de tierra de El Salvador, y los resultados sería que contaminarían más nuestro medio ambiente, las aguas, y sería, ya no sería lo bonito que tenemos ahí en nuestro país, y además no nos daría empleo. Ese trabajo es con maquinarias ordinarias, no es para personas. O sea, hay un montón de cosas que podemos decir, no. No.
So I've been speaking with Agustin Mejivar. He's president of a branch of the Association for the Development of El Salvador, and I'm also speaking with Sarah Bishop, who's the U.S. coordinator of the U.S. El Salvador Sister Cities Network. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Sarah, can you interpret what Agustin just said and put that in context for us?
Sure. So there have been a number of studies on a mine that has been active from 1904 to 2001 in the area of La Union in San Sebastian in El Salvador. And the results of that study showed acid drainage into the river, a number of diseases in present, and so all these negative effects of the mine. And there's been an avalanche of businesses that have been asking for permits to open exploitation, so to open mines. There have been 70 businesses that have asked for permits. And if the government had given them, it would be 50 kilometers squared of land to each business. And that would be using up all the space in El Salvador, which is a very small country. And it would contaminate the environment, the water, and the beauty of the country would be lost. And it's also important to add that jobs wouldn't be gained over the long term from the mining, because the mining uses machinery, not as much people.
And so, Sarah, where do we stand with these lawsuits? And is the U.S. government supporting the companies or supporting the El Salvadoran government?
Well, the lawsuits are in the World Bank, so the U.S. government isn't taking a stand one way or another. And the lawsuit with the Canadian company Pacific Rim is currently in proceedings, and the lawsuit with Commerce Group was rejected and now is in appeal process. They're appealing.
I wanted to ask Agustin a political question. In the 1980s, when the brutal El Salvadoran government, with help from the United States, was massacring tens of thousands of people because they were alleged to be affiliated with the FMLN, the rebels, the left-wing rebels, did he ever imagine that the FMLN would come to power?
Quiero hacer una pregunta político. Cuando el gobierno de El Salvador estaba masacrando la gente con la ayuda del gobierno estadounidense, y había la guerrilla del frente del FMLN, ¿usted imaginó que el FMLN llegaría al poder? Perdón, llegaría al poder del gobierno ahorita, esa pregunta.
Ese era el sueño por el que se luchaba, y lo que había era una presión político-militar del FMLN para pedir que hubieran cambios, o sea, a las violaciones que estaban sucediendo en todos los campos, o sea, porque había violación a los derechos humanos, había inseguridad, la economía era pésima, o sea, no había proyecciones para los pobres y no habían espacios políticos para poder alternar a que hubiera un cambio en las estructuras, porque habían como las delegaciones de los coroneles a otro coronel para estar en el poder. Entonces eso sí había la esperanza porque el pueblo se manifestaba muy fuertemente, a pesar de que habían sido más de 70,000 los muertos desde la década de los 70, los 80, y el pueblo continuaba, o sea, pidiendo que hubiera transparencia, hubiera intervención de las Naciones Unidas, y el frente siempre se mantenía, el FMLN se mantenía demostrando poder, porque en el año de 1989 se proclamó a nivel internacional el Ejército Nacional para la Democracia.
So that's a dream that we fought for the FMLN to be in political power. And what was at the time was military political pressure from the FMLN. Because we were all calling for changes from the human rights violations, the insecurity, the very bad economy, the lack of opportunities for the poor. And there weren't political spaces to advocate for changes. And the military, the government was just military colonels transitioning to different military colonels. And so there was a lot of power and hope in the people that were protesting, even though there were 70,000 deaths between 1970 and 1980. And people kept calling for transparency and kept calling for UN intervention. And that strength was the reason that the FMLN in 1989 began to call themselves a liberation group for democracy.
And Funes is the FMLN candidate who became president. And how is he doing? Is he improving the conditions of the people, Agustín?
¿Y Funes ahora es el candidato? ¿Cómo lo ve? ¿Está mejorando las condiciones?
Sí, hay cambio. Y mucha esperanza de cambio, ya que también ha dado como la participación pluralista de varios sectores. Eso ha consolidado la estabilidad, la seguridad de el presidente para su administración, ya que no ha habido intervención así como punto débil de que la empresa privada pueda, o sea, manipularlo para darle golpe de Estado. O sea, se ve que va evolucionando muy con muchas esperanzas y hay buenas proyecciones que las pudiera decir en este momento.
Yes, we have seen changes and a lot of hope for change as well. And there's been a lot of opportunities for pluralistic participation, many sectors that have been involved. And that's created a lot of stability for his administration. There hasn't been as much intervention or businesses attempting to create coups. And so that's been very good and people feel very hopeful.
And then what about social programs, health or education or social security, things like that?
¿Y de programas sociales, salud, educación, seguro social?
Sobre eso es interesante porque, o sea, hay un programa que se llama Red de Comunidades Solidarias. Este programa encierra como un apoyo a los niños, a las madres que tienen a sus niños para poder alimentarles. Hay otra parte que está ayudándole a como seguro social a personas mayores, ya adultos mayores, y esto no ha sido necesario que participe en lo que fue una pensión como salario antiguo, sino que alguien que ha luchado, ha trabajado por este país, necesita una pensión. Así, de esa forma, y hay mejoras también en los hospitales, en las unidades de salud, todos estos beneficios, o sea, han mejorado. En las escuelas tenemos la ayuda a zapatos, a cuadernos y uniformes, alimento.
Yeah, there's been a lot of interesting programs. One has been the program called the Solidarity Community Network, which supports children, parents, by providing food support for food for children, and also a Social Security program for older adults, for anyone who's been working for our country, not just people that had formal employment, to give them a pension. And the hospitals and health centers have improved, and there have been programs to provide shoes and uniforms and notebooks to children in the schools.
Sarah, is your impression that Funes is very popular in El Salvador right now?
Yeah, it is my impression that he's popular, and I think that the folks in Criptas have shared a really important analysis with us, that you can't expect change to happen overnight, that this is a transition period, that this Funes's government, the FMLN government, was the first change in power since the peace accords. It was the first democratic transition of power to a new political party.
And it was the first left-wing government in decades.
Yeah, in ever.
Right.
So our partners in El Salvador have had this analysis that we should expect to see things slowly because transitions happen over time. So if people are frustrated, we just have to remember that we're in a context of transition.
Are people frustrated? Is there impatience? Maybe Agustín would answer that.
Y hay personas que están frustrados con él o impacientes con que los cambios no están pasando suficientemente rápido.
Quiera sí o no, hay ese tipo de casos. Y más por lo que decía que el Mauricio Funes se identifica como más pluralista, donde toma algunos funcionarios de la empresa privada, otros de otro partido, y así está logrando mantener el poder como interactuando. Entonces hay gente que dice, ¿quién se fue a quedar en ese puesto? Y otro se lo merecía. Pero son cosas que al final el pueblo está viendo que sí hay cambios y hay esperanzas de seguir trabajando para ir construyendo, porque esto es cuestión de también de la evolución en el poder.
Yeah, there has been frustration. One thing that Funes has done is been very pluralistic in his cabinet and the people in his government. So there's people from private business in the government, from other political parties. And some people say those people shouldn't be there. They don't deserve power. But he's involving lots of people in his process. And so I think that people recognize that and are seeing changes and continue to hope for change.
I'm speaking with Sarah Bishop, who's the U.S. coordinator of the U.S. El Salvador Sister Cities Network, and our other guest is Agustín Menjivar, who's president of a branch of the Association for the Development of El Salvador, a group that works hand in glove with the U.S. El Salvador Sister Cities Network. And it's my pleasure to have both of you here. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I see that on your website, and let me give your website, I believe it's elsalvadorsolidarity.org. At elsalvadorsolidarity.org, there is a section on some of the current work that you're doing, and it mentions Honduras. Sarah Bishop, why don't you tell me about that?
Yeah, so a number of the people that are involved in our partner organization in El Salvador were refugees in Honduras and lived in Honduras for a number of years before coming back to El Salvador. And so in June of 2009, when the president of Honduras, Mel Zelaya, was taken out of power in a coup, that really concerned the people in Honduras and really concerned our partners in El Salvador as well. And so they decided that a coup in Honduras against a democratically elected president is not just concern to people in Honduras, but it's a concern to anyone in Latin America and really a risk to democracy. And so we've been encouraged by seeing that dangerous coup happen to really be fighting for human rights in El Salvador and in Honduras and paying attention to what's going on.
Well, what is going on in Honduras, Sarah? What are the human rights implications of this coup? And the government that was elected in questionable elections afterwards.
So since the coup in June of 2009, human rights violations have increased towards members of the growing social movement calling for democracy and calling for change. And so in the past, I believe it's 19 months, there have been 15 journalists that have been killed in Honduras.
Yeah, it's supposed to be one of the most dangerous places in the world for a journalist to to practice our little trade.
Yeah, and hundreds of civilians that have been protesting peacefully, that have been talking about what's going on, that have been going door to door to get signatures to call for an assembly for changes to the Constitution, which is something that the social movement is calling for. Those people have been threatened and murdered and disappeared. And it's an incredibly dangerous human rights situation. And unfortunately, it's one that our government of the U.S. seems to be ignoring.
Why is that? And why did the State Department move so quickly to recognize the new government?
I don't think I know the details of how, you know, how people in the U.S. government make the decisions. But I can say that that it has an effect, that the U.S. support for the new government in Honduras, for the Lobo government, has pressured other governments all over the world, all over Latin America, to also work with Honduras. So the effect of our government's agreement to work with Honduras has created this entire environment of support for the government.
And I see that Funes himself recognized, and El Salvador recognized, the coup, post-coup government. We have less than 2 minutes. I wanted to ask Augustine a question. The coup in Honduras, does it make you fear that there will be a coup in El Salvador?
Solo tenemos 2 minutos, pero quería preguntar, ¿el golpe de Estado en Honduras cree que podría pasar en El Salvador?
Pues, el FMLN en este... El año pasado se pronunció contra un posible intento de golpe de Estado que estaba siendo fabricado a través de la empresa privada, que al final hubo como también en la empresa privada un toque como a paralizar todos los servicios de transporte en el país. Decían que era un llamado de la delincuencia, y que eso iba a suceder, pero el impacto pues se declara que es una prueba como para ver cómo iban a funcionar estos planes de ocultos que tienen.
So one thing that we saw was last year an intent by private business to paralyze all the transportation in the country, and they said it was due to crime, but the FMLN saw it as a way that private business was sort of testing if they could stop the country from functioning.
Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. I do think there's always that risk of a coup, and I wish you all the luck in the work that you do, both of you, Sarah Bishop and Agustin Mejivar. Thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thanks so much for having us.
Gracias. Muchas gracias.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.